weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Big thanks to Roz, Emma and Graham for driving us through the afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 29th of January, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Eno Reardon pays tribute to Thomas Barr as he retires from the track. In soccer, Paul Corrie is in studio ahead of a pivotal night in this season's Champions League. Nadine Doherty has the latest on ladies football. Plus, we've Damien Lawler's Wednesday wrap on Gaelic Games news. If you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game On. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Welcome along. I'm delighted to say Paul Corrie is in a studio with me for the evening because, as well as being a pivotal night in the Champions League, it is the busiest night ever in the Champions League. It's going to get underway at 8 o'clock. There's going to be 18 games. Loads of them have significance. We're going to get through it all in just a while. We're going to decide where we're going to eat as well because it's one of those nights where you're going to have to buckle up, sit down and try and take it all in. But it's going to be great and we'll chat about it. But Paul, first of all, just a little bit on the transfers, because there's a lot of news over the last day or so about where players might be going. It was confirmed today that Republic of Ireland goalkeeper Mark Travers has joined championship side Middlesbrough on loan. So he's coming from Bournemouth. A little bit of uncertainty about Gavin Bazunu and his future. But the big one is Evan Ferguson and where he's going to go. So lots of interesting clubs and interested clubs as well. Bayer Leverkusen in Germany is one. West Ham is still there. Brighton have said that they could see him going permanently. It might be a loan. We're not really sure yet. What do you think is going to happen with Evan Ferguson in the next few days?
I don't know, to be honest with you, Marie. Last week on his In With Chain, I said I didn't see him moving before the transfer window was closed. And that's purely on the basis of his injury record and how few games he has played, not just in recent weeks, but it seems over the last 12 months, he's either been plagued with injuries or starved of opportunities to play in that Brighton team. So it is very hard to know whether or not he's going to move over the next couple of days. It does seem that he's, you know, surplus to requirements at Brighton, and the likes of Danny Welbeck and João Pedro have done incredibly well when they've played in that team. So maybe there is an opportunity for him to go out the door. I would personally, you know, like to see him go to one of those clubs. I think West Ham would be a great fit for him. They don't really have that focal point at the top end of the pitch. Jared Bowen is obviously out injured. Fulkrug hasn't really worked out. Antonio out injured. If he was to get going and get minutes in his legs, you could see him potentially going in there and playing games. And I also think when you hear the likes of a Bayern Leverkusen being touted around, that would be a superb move. And they're still involved in the Champions League, obviously doing wonderful things under Xavi Alonso, and were so impressive last year. And maybe a style of play that would suit Evan. You know, he's very comfortable taking the ball into feet. You would imagine he would be on the end of plenty of chances within that Bayern Leverkusen team. I think, you know, it is important that he just go and play games. You know, he has played so few minutes, Marie, over the last while. The majority of them have been in an Irish jersey. So it's important that he firstly gets back fit, and then secondly starts to get minutes in his legs, because Evan's career started off so brightly but has stalled somewhat over the last 12 months.
I know it's probably like clutching at straws, but it's quite positive that there's so many clubs interested in him. So every time you turn on Sky Sports News, they're talking about him. So like, he is still a big deal, and obviously there's a huge amount of potential there as well.
Yeah, and his age profile is obviously something that clubs will look at and say there's so much potential to develop Evan into a top striker. But it would go to show you there's a real absence and there's a real lack of natural number nines who can hold the ball up, good in the air, and go with the ball at your feet. And he's obviously powerful over 5-10 yards that he could run in behind teams. So I think, you know, there's a lot of clubs that will look at Evan and see his attributes and think that he is somebody who could fit into the way they play. And like I mentioned, there's not a huge amount of number nines out there. But yeah, it is promising from that perspective. He's got oodles of talent, and I'm sure wherever he goes, if he gets up to match sharpness, we've seen that he can do it within the Brighton jersey. He's obviously done it with Ireland as well. But it's about staying fit, Marie. You have to stay fit for long periods of time so you can kind of work your way back into match fitness. And if he does do that, I'm sure there'll be goals to Evan's game. But yeah, this move is going to be interesting. I'd say Brighton are raging they didn't cash in on him 12, 18 months ago, because there was 60, 80, 100 million being banded about. Brighton are a selling club. I'd say they are raging they didn't sell. But Mark Travers, delighted to see him go out. You know, his opportunities were going to be limited behind Kepa. Obviously, our keepers aren't playing a huge amount at this moment in time. So really excited to see how he gets on at Middlesbrough.
Okay, so number nine's on left side of centre backs. That's what everybody's looking for at the moment, yeah?
pretty much.
Okay, we're going to get back to the Champions League in just a while. As I mentioned, it is such a busy night and there's lots at stake. So we'll be going through it all with Paul, but we're turning our attention to athletics because there's big news broke today that three-time Olympian and European medalist Thomas Barr announced his retirement from competitive athletics. He's been around for quite a while. He's made a huge impact on the sport and will no doubt have a lasting legacy as well. I'm delighted to say that Ian O'Riordan joins us now on the line to reflect a bit and celebrate to his career, because Thomas Barr has been a brilliant asset to Irish athletics. I'm sure, Ian, you've been covering him for quite a long time, because often with these athletes that do burst onto the big stage, they've had good junior careers as well. Was that the case with Thomas?
Well, not quite. Now, he was no Rashid Adeleke breaking records all the way underage. In fact, he didn't have any great outstanding success as a junior, but it was around that kind of 19-20 age group where a lot of athletes fall off, that he really started to make the big breakthrough. And in fact, it was 2014, which is 10 years ago last summer, obviously, when he first broke the Irish record, the first Irishman to break 49 seconds. So there was clearly potential there. But I mean, to be honest, if you'd ask me when I first saw Thomas Barr, did I think he was going to be, you know, end up finishing fourth in the Olympics and a European Championship medalist, I would have said probably not. I think some of his colleagues used to call him Bambi back in the early days for his kind of slightly dainty type approach to the hurdles and kind of gangly legs at that stage. And I think he said himself as well, he didn't quite have the speed for the 400 metres flat, so he inevitably ended up in the 400 metre hurdles, which I've never actually run the event, but it's a highly technical event. I mean, people forget this is 10 hurdles laid out over the course of the track, 3 foot high and 13 metres apart. So it's a really difficult event to master, but there's no doubt that Thomas Barr did that.
Yeah, he really did. He said it's technical and getting your stride pattern right and all of that, things that we don't actually think about, because when would we ever be jumping over hurdles, Ian? Very rarely. Let's have a chat about it, though, his attitude, and that seems to be one of the standout things when it comes to Thomas Barr that people mention, and just his dedication to the sport. And he even said himself with his retirement statement that he's given so much of his time, the schedule, the commitment, the dedication, all of that. So when things did fall into place for him, it seemed he really gave it his all.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned at the outset, there was something unique about Thomas. I mean, he always gave his level best. He was incredibly consistent, whether it was winning a national championship, whether on a Diamond League races, and then all the way to the championship event. He always did it with kind of a smile on his face. And whether he'd had a stinker of a run or not, he was always in good form afterwards. He would never decline an interview. He'd always give you his time, obviously to the media and to his supporters as well. So, I mean, that was reflected, I think, in his popularity last summer in Rome when he was part of the mixed relay team that won the gold medal alongside, obviously, Rashid and Charlene and Phil Healy. I mean, he was kind of almost the spark that really lit that team alive. Brought that team alive in the night, and even Rashid admitted to that he brings something special to the relays. But no, I mean, it's the 400 metre hurdles which he'll be remembered for. And if you could go back to Rio in 2016, nearly 10 years ago now, but he was he was still only 22, 23, and had a horrible summer. Like he'd been injured for about 6 weeks and literally had not done any hurdle work at all. So I think he went to Rio thinking he had a couple of races beforehand, and he's like, look, this is great, I'll just go out here and enjoy it. And lo and behold, he got through his qualifying heat, he got through his semi-final, and suddenly he's in the Olympic final. And we're all thinking, look, this is great. This is a huge achievement. None of us thought he was going to be in contention for a medal. And then there he was coming down the home straight, out-dipped on the line by, I think it was 0.05 of a second away from bronze. I remember sitting there and our faces just dropped, like, oh my God, I can't believe he's come so close. And we all rushed down to the mix zone with our kind of long faces ready to console him. And of course, he comes out beaming, delighted, and saying, oh, I'm delighted to have finished fourth. And I do remember thinking at the time, and like, he just won the Irish record as well. He'd run his 47.97, which still stands as the Irish record. That was his chance. You know, when you finish fourth in the Olympics like that, you always think, well, 4 years down the road, things will be better. We saw it again with Rashid Adeleke last year in Paris. So her chance will come again. But I mean, we all had that nagging feeling in the back of our minds that was his chance to win a medal in the Olympics, which would have obviously crowned his career, but doesn't take anything from it mm-hmm. in terms of what he's done for that event in Irish athletics.
Yeah, and I think actually I remember that. He was so surprised himself. He was wearing the same pair of socks for all the races. His lucky socks. I think there was some sort of a situation like that as well. But just in general, though, and you mentioned he'd had that kind of poor summer heading into it. He did seem like someone, though, in that was able to turn it on the big stage, on the big day, even if he'd had a poor run-in or a pre-season or off-season or anything like that.
Yeah, and the other thing about Thomas Barr was he was a completely home-produced athlete. I mean, again, no disrespect to those who go away training with foreign coaches. That's very much part of the process in athletics. But Thomas always stayed local. He had the same coaches most of the way up, Drew and Haley Harrison, and stayed with his Ferrybank Athletic Club down in Waterford. You know, he was very much the homegrown athlete, and he would always show up for the national championships, rain or shine. I think he won 12 or 13. I was trying to add them up there. I may have missed one, so apologies for that. But like a lot of Irish athletes, when they get to that stage of their career, they're like, well, I don't need to run nationals anymore. It's more important to do a Diamond League or whatever. But he always showed up for nationals and always delivered, which again, I think is a huge credit to him. And I mean, I go back to the popularity thing, but it's one thing to be successful in the sport, but to do it with the style that Thomas has done, it just athletes like that don't come along very often. But I think it's worth pointing out as well that he was a huge student of the events. And I even remember talking to him when he was starting out, and I was like he knew obviously about Edwin Moses, who I think he went something like 9 years without losing a race. And he would have known about Bob Tisdall, who won the Olympic gold medal for Ireland back in 1932. So he was a great student of the event as well. And I think that transferred into some of his performances too.
Yeah, he was kind of an infectious guy, as you said, and super to be around, and big performer on the big day. You couldn't really ask for any more from him, though. Like, fourth in the Olympics, as you said, it was his chance. But still, the fact that he'd kind of got there and finished there against the odds, almost, that it's difficult to think that when you look back on his career that he didn't reach his potential. Do you think he did?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. And then of course, like, the event has moved on so much. If you think about what they're running now in the 400 meter hurdle. So even to win that bronze medal in Berlin in 2018 was huge. And as I say, he's still only 32, turns 33 next July. So he's certainly not ancient by running standards. But I think we all kind of suspected that 2024 might have been his last year. Certainly probably going to be his last Olympics. And but I think that decision to retire, the body possibly might have been able to go on for another year. But as he said himself in a few different media outlets today, that, you know, when you're back into that November training and you're trying to get the spikes on in a cold, dark track, and he's like, this is the last place I want to be. And he's already moved on with his life. He's got a few business things going now. He's got a partner for many years now. And I think he's right. Personally, some athletes say, no, you should keep going until the legs fall off, kind of thing. But I think Thomas has made the right decision to step away now. He possibly could have got back into a couple of more mixed relay teams. But I definitely think that what we saw of him over the last 10 years is more than enough to merit his decision to retire now. He's nothing left to prove. He's nothing left to achieve, really. His Irish record, I suspect, will stand for many years, the 47 seconds that I mentioned there. So it's good. He set the bar high, pardon the pun there, but he certainly set the bar high over 400 meter hurdles.
Oh, that's great, Ian. And look, best of luck to Thomas Barr. He gave us some great moments, some great days out and memories, that's for sure, as well. We will talk to you soon, Ian. It's going to be a busy year with the World Athletics Championships coming and the European Indoors as well. So we'll be chatting to you a lot, no doubt. Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Marie. Have a good evening.
Game on. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Now, welcome back. Paul Carey is still with me. We're focusing on tonight's Champions League game, but there's been a little bit of a development on the transfer front. Just at the top of the programme, we were talking about how left-sided centre-backs and number nines were the two positions that were really in demand, and Arsenal have shown exactly why, Paul.
Yeah, and listen, Arsenal have been criticised for not making a move for a number nine over the last couple of windows, but it looks as if they've put a proposal into Villa for £60 million for Ollie Watkins. Now, this has been rejected from Aston Villa already, and Fabrizio Romano was saying that Villa are also in talks with Al Nassr for John Duran. So they're not going to want to lose both of their centre forwards, and you would imagine if they were to lose one, it's more likely to be John Duran than it is Ollie Watkins, given the record that Ollie Watkins has at Aston Villa. So Arsenal making moves, and that's not really too surprising, Marie, given how they've struggled in front of goal at different stages with that number nine. And, you know, Kai Havertz, rightly or wrongly, has been criticised a lot. It hasn't quite happened for Gabriel Jesus. He's now out injured. They're certainly looking to fill that gap, and it looks like they're trying to fill that gap with Ollie Watkins, who has a brilliant record against Arsenal. He scored a lot of goals against them, so maybe that not too helps. Surprising.
Gosh, right. We'll be keeping a very close eye on that. I'm sure the pressure will come on to get that number nine when they're so close, but yet so far, of getting that elusive Premier League.
And you would think, if you're Ollie Watkins, this opportunity isn't likely to come around. I know Aston Villa have done really well over the last couple of years, but to play for Arsenal and be a big club and be the number nine for that side, you would think that is an opportunity that Ollie Watkins will want to pursue.
Definitely.
Not to say he'll get his move.
Yeah. Look, anything can happen. So Champions League, I think it's going to happen tonight as well. So it is the busiest evening in the Champions League, and it's going to start at about 8 o'clock. So 18 matches are going to take place, on which is the final night of the league phase, with the top 24 teams at the end of it all progressing in the competition to different parts of it, whether it's a playoff or straight through. So this means that Premier League champions Man City are under serious pressure, because they're starting the evening in 25th place. But they do know that they will survive if they beat Club Brugge. That game is live actually on RT2 from 7:30, so do tune in to that, and they'll have all of the goals as well from the 18 games. Aston Villa are playing Chelsea, you know, they won lots of interest. Both of them are already a sure progression, but it's where they're going to finish. Arsenal the same, they're in Girona. So only the top 8 go straight through to the last 16, and those who are ranked from 9 to 24th will have an extra two-legged round to get there. Nobody wants that. Liverpool are guaranteed to finish first or second ahead of their match at PSV. So, Paul, Man City, is that the big one? It probably is, because they do need to get that win. And it's interesting because Pep's probably heading into this game with a lot of selection dilemmas. He has made some signings. We saw some of them at the weekend, and they're not eligible to play, though. So what's he going to do? Where's he going to get the players from?
Yeah, well, John Stones came on the weekend for Kucinov, who had an edgy performance, to say the least. I did feel sorry for him.
I felt so sorry for him.
Yeah, he won't be involved tonight. He doesn't speak English, and I think he'd have one or two training sessions. To throw him in against Chelsea will give you an understanding of how many bodies they're missing at the back, but also...
He's won 20.
Yeah, I thought it was a bit unfair. He did regather himself, but it certainly will give you an understanding for the problems they've had at the back. And
the damage was kind of done, because you knew straight away that when he made those few mistakes that the post-match analysis was going to focus on the mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess they're the sort of mistakes that you want to try avoid in tonight's game, because this it does have the potential to be a bit of a banana skin. Everybody's expecting that Man City will win, they'll win convincingly and they'll go through, but we have seen at different stages in this competition, you only have to rewind back to last week ahead against PSG and they threw it away. They were 3-0 up at home against Feyenoord and drew 3-0. They were beaten by Juventus, beaten by Sporting Lisbon, so their form has been very, very patchy within this competition, which is so unlike Man City. And obviously we've seen something similar in the Premier League as well. Club Brugge aren't a bad side. They've had a few decent results against Villa and Juventus earlier on in this competition. They do have the potential to potentially cause an upset, but you would have to fancy Man City. I mean, just with the players that they have, the experience they have within that side, you would expect them to score goals tonight. But if they are to be as frail as they have been at the back, and if they were to go behind, you could definitely see nerves setting in within the stadium.
Yeah, the nerves have to be there, Paul, really, because the consistent performances, particularly around the defence, haven't been there. And there's so much pressure riding on it as well. And I'm not sure how good Pep copes with all the pressure.
Yeah, and they folded last week against PSG after being ahead and in cruise control, really, 2-0 ahead. I thought they folded when pressure started to tell. And the thing about Man City when you're playing against them is if you stay within the game, you always feel like you're going to get a chance, particularly on transitions. They don't seem to have the same sort of energy to be able to cover the gaps. They're obviously missing Rodri. The back players, Kyle Walker included, who's now gone out the door, have looked very, very exposed at different times throughout this season. So if that was to materialise, if they didn't score, let's say, in the first half and it was starting to get towards the hour mark and they're without a goal, you could potentially see nerves starting to set in. And that's when you're, if you're Club Brugge, counterattacks, transitions, you could get an opportunity to sting Man City, but you would still fancy them with the players. I thought they were decent enough against Chelsea on the weekend, probably looking a little bit more like themselves. They should have enough. Like, in a once-off game to get into that playoff round, Man City should really be beating Club Brugge.
I thought it was very curious. The age profile of Pep's three signings are all so young that there must be a concern when he looks at the players in the squad that he has, that they are aging up a bit.
Yeah, and that's maybe to be expected given the number of games that this squad has had to play over the last 3-4 years. If you take Man City and you compare them to, say, an Aston Villa or a Newcastle who've been involved in this competition, look how difficult they have found it to balance the Champions League and then be consistent within the Premier League. Man City have done that brilliantly over the last 3-4 years. Maybe that toll is going to take shape on that squad over a period of time. Pep has been criticised for not refreshing the squad, but you can't forget what it is they have achieved and what those players have done. But yeah, you're right in saying that there will be younger players coming into that squad, and maybe he'll look to phase some of the more experienced and older ones out of that team, because at times, Marie, the energy has really been lacking from Man City.
Yeah, definitely. He's a bit of work to do though, so we'll see how that goes. PSV against Liverpool. Arne Slot Slide have been so good in the league phase 8 wins out of 8. Moving into the round of 16 as the top team, they've been dominant, but he's made a lot of changes. Now, he says in his press conference he still wants to win the game, and that's really important to them, and players are getting an opportunity. But he has moved a lot of personnel out, a lot of experienced personnel out. Cuevan Kelleher is in, which is positive for Ireland, obviously, but there's still a lot of changes there.
Yeah, and I guess we should expect that. It's coming towards that sort of business part of the season where in the Premier League they want to, I guess, maintain that cushion that they have at the top of the league. And he's in such a brilliant situation in the Champions League where they've, you know, 100% record, guaranteed top spot. He can afford to rest the top players knowing that they're going to be safely into the next round and safely top of the pile. And he's got them players who are, I guess, dying to get into that starting 11 and give them an opportunity to show what it is they are made of. And he's obviously got a really good squad to pick from. So Liverpool in such a good position, and irrespective of what 11 they put out, Marie, we saw it last week when they played Lille, they just look in cruise control. They really do. Like, even maybe when they're not at their best, they're still creating chances, still scoring goals. And when you have somebody like Van Dijk at the back, he seems to bring such a calm and a presence to their back four that they always look solid. He's able to organise people around him. He's obviously got Alisson behind him who does similar. But they just look like a very, very well-oiled machine at this moment in time. And I'm sure he's delighted with the tinkering he's done with the side and the tinkering he's done with how they play and how they set up compared to what maybe the more chaotic approach of Jurgen Klopp and how the players have bought into this new system and new style. But they look so good in all competitions. They're still involved in all four as well. Not to say that they'll go on and do a quadruple, but they could certainly go deep in a lot of these competitions.
It's remarkable the way they've reacted to him, Paul, isn't it? When you think of the big character that Jurgen Klopp was and the expectation that came with him leaving, that there'd be a void there, but he has just been able to get the best out of this group of players.
Yeah, he has. And maybe a new voice was beneficial for some of those players. You know, if you're listening to Jurgen Klopp's voice for however long a period of time, maybe sometimes players get tired of that. And that's not to say that they don't believe in the manager, but somebody coming in with fresh ideas and a fresh approach can maybe rejuvenate some of those individuals. And, you know, Salah's form has been incredible. Even Ryan Gravenberch, the way he has grown into that position, McAllister seems to have gone up to another level. A lot of the players have progressed. It's probably only Andy Robertson who's maybe regressed, and that's maybe legs and that's his age and the profile of where he is at in his career. He's maybe one who might be looking to stiffen a bit of competition in that position. But other than that, it seems as if everybody's bought into how he wants to play. There's certainly more control about how Liverpool go about their business, and that is very evident in their performances.
I like his messages as well. They just centre around tackling, work rate, you know, they're getting the basics right. So
yeah, and he's very impressive in press conferences. Yeah. I think he comes across really well.
Yeah, he really does. Trent Coney-Doherty, young Irish player, is in the squad. Not sure he's going to get a run. He's very, very young, but What a brilliant experience.
Yeah, incredible. There's good bonuses involved as well in Champions League if you can get yourself on the bench. But he is one who, even when you see like the little clips online of Liverpool when they're involved in the UEFA competition at youth level, he seems to be somebody who's popped up with goals, and he was obviously spoken about a little bit here before he went away. So even to just get a flavour of being in around the first team, how they prepare, how professional they are when approaching games like this, and just being able to experience the night will be fantastic for him and maybe give him a bit of flavour of what potentially lies ahead if things were to go well.
Absolutely. Like, that's a vote of confidence from the manager.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And they don't, you know, these aren't token gestures, Marie, when you're playing with top clubs.
This
they
is
only
big boy
do
football.
It.
Yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
Aston Villa and Celtic. So we know that Aston Villa are knockout stage bound under Unai Emery, which is brilliant for them. They've been really, really good, but they are on the outside looking in of that top eight, no doubt. Like everybody else, they're going to want to get that win and hope that results go their way to see whether they have that playoff or that bye. But they've been a real success story in Europe this year, Paul.
Yeah, they have. And it's a testament to Unai Emery and the job that he's done at Aston Villa that we're talking about. The club being involved in the last 16 of the Champions League. Like, that is some journey that they have been on from taking over from Steven Gerrard. What is it, maybe two and a half years ago, and the squad that he's built there, the way he has them playing, the progression that we've seen in individuals and the team as a whole, and they put themselves in a really good position of qualifying within the top eight. I think they found it difficult this year, Marie, just to balance the Premier League and Champions League. Maybe it's the size of the squad. Unai Emery doesn't tend to rotate too much, and at times I think the energy has been lacking within some of their performances. And particularly at the back, they've lost Pau Torres, who's such a huge part for how they play out from the back and through the thirds, but also from a defensive perspective. I think his absence at the back has been felt. And then also Tyrone Mings, who's been plagued with bad injuries going off in the weekend. They've maybe lacked that bit of presence at the back that they've had. So you would expect them to have a little bit too much for Celtic. Celtic did their hard work last week against Young Boys. But for Aston Villa to be even within the conversation of qualifying in the top eight is just a testament to the job that Emery has done there.
Yeah, lots of Irish Aston Villa fans as well, no doubt enjoying every bit of it. Celtic though as well, like, we know that Brendan Rodgers wanted them in this season to be competitive in Europe, and they have certainly done that, Paul.
Yeah, they have, and that's maybe the piece of the jigsaw that's been lacking from Celtic over the last couple of years is the performances and results that they've managed to achieve within Europe. And they had some difficult nights within this competition. I think if you rewind back, the first game they played was against Borussia Dortmund, and they were beaten 7-1 away from home. And I'd say that was a bit of a shock to the system, to Brendan Rodgers, but also to the squad, to maybe understand that you can't play in Europe the way that you do in the Scottish Premier League and try to be as expansive and as potentially get exposed a little more in Europe. Yeah, but they've tightened up and they've probably been a little bit more pragmatic within how they play. The result last week was huge because it gets them into that playoff round, and that was a huge opportunity at home against Young Boys to really make a mark on this competition. And Adam Ida, obviously very involved within that goal last week. Great to see himself playing minutes. Liam Scales has obviously been involved within this competition as well. So great to see the Irish presence there. And, you know, whatever happens from here is probably a bonus. But I think Brendan Rodgers and the club, particularly with the money that's available within the Champions League, like, to get into that qualifying round is a huge, huge bonus for them. It's a bit of a look at the draw now, who they get in that round, that playoff round, to get into the last 16 and see how far they can go. But a hell of a journey.
Another must watch game is Stuttgart against PSG, because there's only a couple of places separating them. So Stuttgart are in 24th spot. PSG are just two places above them in 22nd. So the only thing separating the two sides is goal difference. Stuttgart have scored more goals than PSG so far in this league phase. So that could be a good one too.
Yeah, it should be. And watching PSG last week, I was really impressed with them. It's obviously a different makeup, and Luis Enrique is shaking it up a bit, obviously losing Mbappe. You know, we're gone the days of Messi, Neymar and Mbappe at the top end of the pitch. It's a much younger, much more energetic PSG side that we're seeing. I personally, I know we're talking about them qualifying tonight, I could personally see them going quite deep in the competition. I think they've been dealt a really, really bad card within the Champions League. They've had to play Man City. Mm-hmm. They've had to play Bayern Munich, Atletico Madrid, and Arsenal within this league phase. So some of the hands that are being dealt are a little more favourable. PSG have had a really difficult run of fixtures within this competition. I would expect them to win tonight against Stuttgart, and I'm expecting them, Marie, to go deep into this competition. And I say the same about Man City. I still think if Man City can get through tonight, I think over two legs they're going to be a difficult team to beat. I expect them to get better as the competition goes on. And they're two sides that I would expect to go a little bit deeper in this competition.
Okay, lots to look forward to and lots to analyse tomorrow as well. We're going to take a very quick break. But do stay with us. We'll be keeping an eye on any other football news because there seems to be a lot of it all of the time during this transfer window. We'll also be talking Gaelic games with Damien Lawler, and Nadine Doherty is standing by as well to reflect and review on the weekend's ladies' football action.
RTE 2FM.
Now we're turning our attention to Gaelic games. I'm delighted to say that Damien Lawler is with me on the line. Damien, how are you? A busy time when you're working in Gaelic games at the moment. The new rules, we saw them in action over the weekend. I know they've been tested out for quite a few months, but still a lot for everybody to get their heads around. How have they been received?
Marie, that's a great question because there has been a serious reaction to it anyway, that's for sure. The Downross Common game is probably the poster boy for it. The game that we covered in RT2 last week, Galway versus Armagh, that wasn't entirely dissimilar to the All-Ireland final last year. So, you don't see any great change in that regard. And then you probably had a little bit of a mix-up over the FRC sending their kind of confirmed rules for now on, but those rules not being entirely reflected in the GEA rulebook or the official kind of rules guide, resulting in Kieran McGeaney getting the wrong end of the stick from communication he received. So I think there's been a couple of little grey areas this week. There's no point in saying otherwise. I think that the rules guide is finalised for now. But don't forget, Marie, after round two of the Allianz Football League, the FRC, if they see fit, can start making tweaks from that point onwards. And those tweaks can go right to maybe the league final, whereby you're road testing the last couple of ones in time for this year's championship. And then again, at the end of this year's championship, what will go forward then will be the Special Congress 2025, and they'll be completely and permanently ratified for the 2026 rulebook going forward. But it's not a simple process. For every rule or every key enhancement, for want of a better description, that Jim Gavin and his FRC recommends, there are three or four little variables that come off it, like three or four what ifs. So to answer your question, we did not see much difference between Armagh and Galway last week. Armagh still formed that defensive wall around the 40. They did it very, very well in the first half. Galway didn't have the punch to get through it. But maybe as the half went on, they got a little bit more direct and they got a little bit more leeway. So all sorts of varying reaction to it. Earlier today, I spoke to Brian Lacey, who was a former All-Star. Brian's been involved in intercounty coaching both with Tipperary and Kildare, getting tipped to an All-Ireland semi-final and being with Kildare up to last year. But he's also an accredited GEA performance analyst, level 3. So he eats this stuff for breakfast. And Brian is just concerned that the weaker counties, when push comes to shove, will not have the squad depth to be able to cope with the more explosive nature of the game, with the middle third especially being up and down that field. Now, we have to wait for data to come out of the GEA to see if that's actually accurate and that's being reflected. But Brian has actually recommended that the prospect of going back to 60 minutes be looked at again, because such is the load on players now that he feels that it's worth looking at. Brian is also not a fan of the 12 versus 11. And you see from players, managers like Paddy Talley across the week, there's a lot of reservations about the 12 versus 11, Marie, whereby there's a lot of repetition with the ball, a lot of sideways passing like we saw last year. And they are issues that maybe haven't really found the mark with the public just yet. The handing the ball back to your opponent, that's still a debate over that. If a corner forward is sneaking in behind you and you're handing the ball back to the wing forward, you're leaving yourself wide open. So you have to be practical about that too. However, some stuff is working really well. Like the one versus one, there's hardly any issues with that, I don't think. Three versus three, there's been a couple of areas whereby it hasn't been maybe entirely policed, but by and large, players are self-policing that. And then finally, Marie, the solo and go. As I spoke to you last week, we played an under-14 match and players hesitated for a second. They weren't able to go with the solo and go. But maybe next time out now, every player will make that instant decision to go with the ball. And I think at inter-county level, they've already started to do that. There's been a massive reaction. It's early days yet. You certainly don't have enough data in to make any dramatic judgments or any dramatic calls. The 12 versus 11, though, that does stick out as being something that could be in line for a tweak. I'm not so sure if it will be. I think a lot of referees feel that that's there now for the year. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what you felt yourself, but again, the Down versus Roscommon game was all that was good about the new rules. It was end-to-end. You had your tap-and-goes. You had your load of two-pointers. You had a turnover and the goalkeeper being caught out of position. And it was very, very exciting to watch.
Yeah, I'm a bit like you, Damien. There's positives and negatives. And the two games that I watched were the Galway Armagh and then the Down Roscommon. So there were variations. Yeah. Although I think if you're a team and you're coming up against an Armagh or Galway or teams that are right up at the very top of the tree, there would be a little bit more conservatism, and I can see why there was a huge amount of the hand passing over and back, but it wasn't great to watch. But something you mentioned there was the under-14s, and I'm curious as well about how the younger players are adapting and how it's been received, because we're talking about the top level all the time, but the kids have to play it too, Damien, and it's a big change.
Yeah, and we played our game on a municipal pitch, Marie, and this is again something that Brian Lacey referenced today in the interview, which will hopefully go out in the next few days over RTE, but so many lines on the pitch, Marie. So many lines on the pitch, especially if you're using a pitch that maybe, you know, the Astra pitch that has been used for soccer as well. And, you know, you have a 45-metre line, you have a 40-metre arc, you have a halfway line, and then you have the same again in the other half. So the players were finding it. Like, you're asking me kind of which line to come out or which arc. And we definitely had a situation where maybe the players that we were playing against, maybe the three versus three, we were trying to keep our three up at the top of the whole time. And then at the same time, the opposition maybe were, you know, everybody's looking at the far end of the field. Nobody was doing anything deliberately. But the referee definitely pinged us for the three versus three. The tap and go did not work at all because the lads weren't ready. They thought they were ready. They thought they were reacting very, very quickly, but they hesitated for a second or two, and the solo and go invariably wasn't allowed to happen then. And then really, a windy night getting beyond the 40-metre arc, I struggled to do it myself, so asking under-14s. But in fairness, they were able to do that. They were able to get it past the 40-metre arc, so that was okay. The descent thing, I think maybe one word out of line and the ball is brought up to the 30-metre line. And look, that's fine. The players have to get the grips of that as well. But certainly, if any of us Egypts were getting vociferous from the sideline, Marie, you won't be doing that anymore. Yeah. Anyway, so you know yourself, the dissent and the culture of the GEA and respect towards referees. If we're serious about treating match officials, there's an unbelievable decline of referees at grassroots level, and many of them are doing two or three games a day because of the shortage. So if we're serious about rectifying that problem, more respect and I suppose gratitude has to be shown towards them. Again, that will require a culture change too. So you're going again, Marie. I go back to March 31st too, and the inter-county thing will find its own feet. There's no doubt about that. All the data will be centred on it. There's enough match officials. There's enough kind of spotlight on the inter-county. It's March the 31st. It's what's going to bed in for club level, and it's certainly I'd be more concerned about underage club level too with my coaching things. That's going to be really interesting too, you know. And how are you going to police all that? Because most games I go to, Marie, our club has to supply a linesman and two umpires, you know, and the referee is literally on his or her own, you know. So it's that's where the challenge will lie. I mean, I wonder, is it a possibility that maybe only two or three of these recommendations might come through to club level? I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting time for it, for sure, because, you know, in a way, I can
it's getting
see
us through January,
yeah,
Marie.
Yeah,
anyway,
absolutely,
sure.
Yeah. But I can see why that they'd want to have uniformity as well, just to have clarity.
Yeah, you're right. I say that about club level, but you know what? Maybe it doesn't make any sense. You're probably right to have that uniformity. You know, you probably are.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll wait and see, Damien. So look, everyone's off the mark now. A lot of interest in how the different teams would fare in divisions. Out of everyone you've seen or you've heard of, who has caught your eyes making a good start to the Allianz League?
Yeah, look, no doubt about it. Like, Roscommon got off to a belter, that's for sure. I feel, though, that the other story for me from the weekend was Offaly. You know, they were at home to Sligo. Looking in, there didn't seem to be a massive crowd, even though it was Mickey Hart's first game alongside Declan Kelly. He's co-manager there now, obviously. Sligo have been building nicely under Tony McEntee. Came within a whisker of beating Galway in the Connacht Championship last year. And look how Galway got a late score. And look how they kind of carried out the rest of the year, Marie. But Sligo then were kind of tipped, you know, have they got a chance of winning a Tailteann Cup here? And the great work that's been done with them, they're a well-coached side. So I think a lot of people are expecting Sligo maybe to come up from Division 3 this year and to get off the really, really good start against Offaly. But Offaly had a 7-point win. And, you know, again, people will say, hang on now, Sligo kicked that game away. They hit 15 wides. There's no getting away from that. But Offaly were well-structured. They were well in control of that game at halftime. They slipped away maybe a bit towards halftime. I think Sligo hit 4 or 5 unanswered points. But the likes of Keane O'Neill, you know, the likes of Dominican, Kyle Flynn, Cormac Egan, the under-20s coming mm-hmm. through. There's a lovely, lovely mix there. But you could see Mickey Hart stamp on it, Marie. Anyway, as far as I was concerned, they were composed. They were fit as fleas. They waited patiently for the gaps to appear. And they hit a lovely, handsome, was it 117, I think? And in these conditions, that's really, really impressive. And you just wonder then, like, can they maintain this? And could they maintain a promotion push? And that would be massive then for Offaly to go back up to Division 2 again, you know. Like, it's a long way off yet. And you're looking at maybe Antrim, Offaly, Sligo, they're all there, like, you know. And there's other counties there with a win as well. So it's going to be a really interesting division. But again, Mickey Hart and Declan Kelly under 20, All-Ireland winning manager, Mickey Hart, Gaelic Games legend. It'd just be a really, really interesting one to watch as the season unfolds. And they're off to a flyer. They are off to a flyer. And maybe if they can maintain that pace, another 2 or 3 wins, Marie. Another 2 or 3 wins. And they're right up there for promotion already.
It's all about getting points on the board, Damien, isn't it?
yeah, from an early stage, yeah. And getting that momentum. And I suppose if you look over in the sideline and you see Mickey Hart there with the hands in the pockets, studying the form, and you know you see Declan Kelly alongside him, both men have won All Ireland at various levels, but certainly the sight of Mickey Hart, you're going to be more reassured, aren't you? You're going to be more maybe. Would you have a little bit more belief with the likes of him involved? Mick O'Dwyer had it with Wicklow and other counties when he arrives, and Paddy had it as well, you know. So these, for all the science and all the data that were handed and all the GPSs and the trackers, you know, there's a lot to be said for presence, you know, and Mickey Hart's book was called that too. Presence is the only thing.
Damien Lawler, thank you for all of that, and we'll talk to you soon.
Game on. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Welcome back. We have a new guest in studio. You might have heard her giving us some fashion tips there. Nadine Doherty has walked in to tell us all about the weekend's ladies football action and look ahead to what's coming down the track next weekend as well. Paul Corrie is here, eagerly anticipating the busiest night of Champions League football that we've ever had. But we are going to focus on the ladies football now because it is back. The big teams are back. We got a little bit of a view of what they look like without some key players and manager changes and all that sort of stuff. The big game was Kerry, the All-Ireland champions, against Armagh down in Austinstack Park. Kerry with a new manager, Armagh with lots of players coming back, but both teams down players as well. It was Kerry 113, Armagh 311. Did we learn anything from these two teams, Nadine?
Nothing about fashion in Oymery. No, not this early in the year, but it was actually a really good game because I was here last week with Shane and I didn't have high hopes for the league because of all the changes you've aforementioned. But it's a great game. I think with Kerry, Marie, they'll probably still be wondering how they lost the game. I think they look back at that second half, not the last 8 minutes when Armagh scored the 3 goals, but it was the start of that second half, say the first 10, 15 minutes. They were 6 points up the whole way, cruising, and they missed 3 really, really clear goal chances. Kayleigh Cronin blasted over the bar when there was a goal on, and then Anna Carr made 2 really, really good saves. So I think with Kerry, looking at them, possibly learned a little bit in that they have still, having lost 13 players in the panel last year, they still have a solid crew there up the middle. And I think with Armagh, I think they're just only going to get better. Both teams will be replenishing their first 15, obviously, as the year goes on. But no, it was really good football. I think with Armagh, what's a little bit different from last year. They're probably a little bit, I can't use the word slicker, I suppose, so early in the year, but they have a little bit of a different dimension up front. And I'd say it's the influence of the two lads. They're looking for goals, Marie. And, you know, obviously they got those three goals. But, you know, last year we would have seen a huge amount of recycling, not a huge amount of penetration. Whereas this year they're really looking at those lines of running. So they were really good at moving the ball through the hands. In terms of forwards, obviously they're still waiting on Amy Mackin to come back, but Eve Lavery was very lively and Neve Reid looked really, really good in the corner. I know it's only the first game and it's very early, but I think she will have an impact on that first 15 this year. Armagh probably had a little bit more in the legs in that last 10 minutes and that's where they got the three goals from. But I also think Kerry just, I think with their sideline, it was funny. They conceded that first goal. They were clearly rattled. And the management obviously had it in their heads that they wanted to give girls a game in the last 5-10 minutes. And they proceeded with the substitutions and they just couldn't get settled after that. And then Armagh were able to pick
game
off.
Game management, Nadine?
I think so, yeah. And Armagh probably had a little bit more. Now, the three goals they scored were unbelievable finishes. I mean, Blaheen Mackin's finish for the first goal was unreal. But yeah, Kerry, look, they will be disappointed, but they won't be worried at all. And I think they will be happy. Both teams will be very happy with the performance so early in the year and for their first game out. And I think looking at the, you know, Sheaf Roche was very good in attack. And we're talking about Kerry losing these players from last year. When you look at it realistically, they didn't really have Sheaf Roche up until the last month of championship football. So she's going to be there for the full year. And I caught Lynch again. She was absent for long periods last year with injury and she'll be back. So, you know, Kerry, they're in good stead. But I think across the board, and we look at other games, I just think this year it's going to be fairly even, Marie. And I think there's four or five teams there who will have real and realistic aspirations at winning that All-Ireland. And again, it's early in the year to talk about. But I just think that perhaps the standard will drop a little bit, but it'll even out the championship even more.
Would you put both Dublin and Mayo in that?
Dublin definitely. Mayo, I'll come back to you in a few weeks. I don't know. I think both teams, even their lineouts, were very different. But I think Dublin have retained a lot of big names from last year, whereas Mayo have lost a lot of household names. I think Dublin will have a new energy about them with the two lads in there. I think there'll be a lot of players there who'll want to impress. People will come back later in the year. Mayo, a lot of new names. Marie, that I suppose we'll have to find out more about them. But a big boost for them with Sinead Walsh coming back in. She's been absent for the last 2 years for whatever reasons. Really lovely footballer. Like, she's a real class act. She picked up a good few scores there at the weekend. She's good from play. She's good from set pieces. So she's a big boost having back. But I think both teams, if Mayo are to have an impact, they need more forwards. And I think for Dublin, Carla Rowe has to be fit for the year. Kate Sullivan has to be fit for the year because there are gaps in attack. You know, they did have a lot of players who were familiar with their two goal scorers, Rebecca McDonald, Chloe Darby. You have Niamh Heatherton in there, Jodie Egan. You know, these are all girls who've been on that panel for a long time. But for me, they just probably don't have that killer instinct and they haven't developed it at this stage. So it'll be fine for the league, but come championship you need your Carla Rose and Kate Sullivans and these girls.
Yeah, you need your big players.
You do, absolutely.
Lots of experience though on in all of those teams. And lots to look forward to. It's great to get it up and going. That is all we have time for. Just a little bit of news to bring you before we finish up. Tom McKibben has officially signed for LIV Golf with John Rahm, talking to X this afternoon to announce that he has joined his Legion team. So we're going to be chatting about that, no doubt, over the next few days. And there'll be lots of reaction. It's been was muted for a while. Roy McIlroy had his say on it as well. It's become quite the talking point. Paul Corrie and Nadine Doherty, thank you so much for coming in. We're heading off to Cork tomorrow for the under-20s Six Nations Ireland against England. We will be at Musgrave Park for that big game on the Roadcaster, so do come and say hello to us. We'll have lots of Cork guests, of course, setting us up for the game and for the sporting weekend as well. So that's it. Betty De Silva and the New Music Show are up next.